Good evening, welcome. My name is Jerry, I'm an alcoholic. I get the privilege to introduce Carl. And everybody knows we have the international conference coming up this weekend, and there's a lot of people coming in town for it. And we thought about bringing in a speaker and sharing him around a little bit with the Atlanta Roundup Committee, with the Fifth Tradition Group, and our group. We try to do those kind of things. And then, who could we ask to come into Atlanta a little early? And, you know, we threw some names on the table, and we got down to the bottom of the barrel, and finally Carl's name came up. And we go like, well, how are we going to get him here? And I said, you know, I know Carl a little bit, and if we dangle a little bit of golf out there, we can get him to speak a lot. And he's an avid golfer, which I don't hook up with at all. I don't get it chasing around a little ball, but he likes it. He's also a big football fan, Seattle Seahawks, I guess. I've never heard of him. Big fan. Don't get that. He's a dad. I'm not a dad. He has an amazing business that helps people like the people sitting in this room, none of which really any part of my story. However, when you get to know Carl and you get to listen to his story, he's a drunk. At heart, he's a drunk, and he's got a really good story, and he tells it really well, and we're really honored and privileged to have Carl Morris with us tonight. And I'll give you a call.
Good evening, my name's Carl, I'm an alcoholic. And after that introduction, I think I want to thank Jerry for bringing me out here. Can I move this down? Will that? There we go. Oh, and it's good to see my friend Larry. Where are you, Larry? There you are. He took me to Zesto's last night, and Jerry took me to Fleming's tonight. So which one's a better friend? Anyway, I'm an alcoholic. It's the most important thing I can tell you about myself is that I'm an alcoholic. I could tell you a lot of things that I aspire to be, that I try to be, that I have been successful at, that I have failed miserably at, things that I wish I wouldn't have done, things that I wish I could do, all sorts of things about my life I could talk about, but there is nothing that is more defining about who Carl Morris is than the fact that I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 21st, 1987. I'm 54 years old, so I've been an Alcoholics Anonymous sober over half my life. And drunk or sober, the fact that I'm an alcoholic has been the thing that has driven my bus. And the reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is really very simple. It's not complicated at all. The reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is because I've got a really bizarre relationship with alcohol. That's why I'm an alcoholic. No other reason. And this strange relationship that I have with alcohol takes on a few forms. The first part of this strange relationship that I have with alcohol happens when I drink it. A very strange thing happens when I drink booze, and the book calls it an allergic reaction. And the book says the symptom of this allergic reaction that I get when I drink alcohol is what they refer to as the phenomenon of craving. And the best way that I can describe this thing that the book calls the phenomenon of craving in my life is that it seems like whenever I drink booze, the more booze I drink, the thirstier I get. It happens with nothing else, just booze. An example of that is they're kind enough to give me this bottle of water. And over the next 45 minutes to an hour, or maybe 3 hours that I'm talking with you, I will probably drink half this bottle of water. I don't know. I might finish the whole bottle of water if my mouth gets dry. But I can absolutely guarantee that once I finish this bottle of water, I am not going to go get a case of water and lock myself in a motel room. There is no chance of that happening. There's no chance that later tonight I'm going to call up Will back there and go, come on, hurry here, I need another case. I'll turn the pink slip of my car over. That's not going to happen. But if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, this bizarre physical reaction that I get, if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, well then, Just Say No would have wiped out alcoholism, right? Early 80s, Nancy Reagan came out and said, Just Say No. And if that would have worked, I guess I would have, and I imagine you would have gone, ha ha, no, and just gone on and lived a happy, successful life just saying no. But I've got this other strange part of my relationship with alcohol, and that happens when I'm not drinking. Of and by myself, if I don't drink for a day, a week, or a month, I seem to have this mind that has the ability to paint a picture that makes it okay to take another drink no matter what the pain, humiliation, and suffering was a day, a week, or a month ago. and it never seems to enter into the equation of the decision-making process, whether it was my pain and humiliation or your pain and humiliation. I could care less. But sooner or later, my mind is able to rationalize and justify my walk back to the next drink at all costs. So I can't drink successfully because it's a bizarre physical reaction that I get, but I cannot of and by myself not drink successfully. I'm damned if I do, and I'm damned if I don't. It's the ultimate catch-22 we call alcoholism, because if I could do either one of those two things successfully, I would. I'm going to harp on that physical feature just a little bit more because it's the one thing, bar none, we all have in common. Because if you're new or fairly new and somebody has told you just to sit in meetings until you hear your story, you might be sitting here a long, long time. Because we are a huge, wide cross-section of society. Every single different race, creed, color, religion, background, good family, bad family, education, no education, we're all here. Right? We're the huge, wide cross-section of society. In fact, Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place where the bank president, the bank teller, and the bank robber are all right here in the same room. Right? And they're all telling a very different story about what just happened. So our stories are different based upon our backgrounds and circumstances, but we also drink differently than each other. We really do. To illustrate that, let's imagine this, that we open up that back room, where these people are coming in late. Hi, guys. And hi. And we wheeled in a giant cart right up to the front here. And on that cart, we had all the kinds of booze we all like. If you're a top shelf expensive drinker, we got it. We got some Remy Martin, some Glacier. Great. If you're a bottom shelf drinker, we got that too. Mad Dog 2020 and Boone's Farm, right? We got it. Whatever you want. And everything in between. And let's say we all took a good 4 or 5 really stiff drinks, real drinks, no umbrellas, no spritzer in there, no mixer, good 4 or 5 stiff drinks. We would all be acting very, very differently from each other, right? Over in this corner, we'd have the good time crowd. Ha, 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 talk, 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 fun, fun, ha, ha, talk, talk, add a little methamphetamine, talk a little faster, talk, 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 right? But we're having a good time over here, right? The good time crowd. Then over in that corner, we got the sobbers. You know them, just sit at home, right? Over in that corner, we got the fighters, right? Get 4 drinks in, you're always fighting, always fighting. Over in this corner, a bunch of us would be naked. Right? I personally would be visiting each corner trying to find a couple of friends to come over here with me. So our stories are different on that level too, because over here at the good time crowd, right? They get a lot of DUIs, right? Always, hey, next bar, next party, come on, let's go. Who's stopping at the liquor store so we can drink at Joe's house afterwards? Come on, let's go. So they're getting arrested out on the road a lot. Over in the sobbing corner, no DUIs. They don't even leave the house. They're just, whoa! The worst thing they do is late night drunk dialing, whoa, right? Or maybe, God forbid, these days, drunk Facebooking, right? Right, so no big penalties over there. Over in the fighting corner, they got probation, they got parole, they've got lawyers, they've got court dates in their story, right? That's all going on over there. Over here, bunch of children show up by surprise. So our stories are very different on that level too. But no matter which corner we are in, no matter which corner we're in, there's one thing we would all be doing. We'd all be back at the cart for more. Right? So I needed to know that when I was new as to what to listen to in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in order to identify. I don't care where you come from or where you grew up or what you do for a living or anything about your life, but I can identify if I listen to what happens to you when you do drink and what happens to you on your own when you try not to drink. And I can identify with anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous on that level. I set this relationship up with alcohol that I just described to you right from the get-go when I first started drinking, and I started drinking a lot later than a lot of people in AA. I was 11. It is very late these days. And we lived in Seattle. A typical morning for me in seventh grade would be I'd show up early for school, not for study hall or anything, but to meet my new friends at the very edge of the school property, Loser's Corner. Every school's got a Loser's Corner. It's about 10 feet off of the school property. It's like where they put the smokers from at an AA meeting these days, just shoving you off farther and farther off the property. right? And we would sit out there in the morning, smoke cigarettes, and we would also have what I like to call the playground cocktail. That is a jar full of whatever you could rip off out of the parents' liquor can the night before. And that jar is pretty scary because none of us have been to bartending school yet. So they're, you know, and you're in a hurry. You're in a hurry when you're ripping off the parents, right? Right? So there's equal amounts of whiskey, vodka, cream de menthe, vermouth all in that jar. You can imagine six or seven of us 11, 12-year-olds trying to choke that down at 7 in the morning. Of course, it was the early 70s, so we're smoking that commercial pot. Anybody remember that stuff? Four-finger lids, $10 a bag, seeds and stems and the whole bit. And it was even before Ziploc baggies were invented, when it would just be a regular Glad sandwich bag, and as you'd roll it up, there'd be like nine people spit on it, like, oh, man. Were you guys there, too? It's at this point that many people that speak in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, they often interrupt themselves and they say something like this. I don't mean to offend anybody, but drugs are a part of my story. I understand and I have great respect for what they're attempting to do when they say that. They're attempting to protect singleness of purpose. Vitally important aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous and should never be forgotten. But that idea aside, I still think it's a bizarre practice for alcoholics to apologize to other alcoholics for doing drugs while drinking or in between drunks. See, I understand apologizing to police officers and judges and people that may still love us, but I don't know why we apologize to each other. In fact, the most bizarre example of that I've ever seen, I was in this big meeting in West Los Angeles quite a few years ago, and the speaker that night was just giving one of the most ugly, nasty, heinous, blow-by-blow drunk logs I've ever heard. And I gotta tell you, when I'm out there listening and the speaker's story gets ugly, the uglier it gets, the more excited I get. I think that night I was on the edge of my chair drooling, looking at me, yeah, buddy, go, 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 go. And at one point in this really ugly story, this guy said, you know, I had four DUIs. And the judge said, if I get one more DUI, I'm going to prison for sure. He says, 2 weeks later, I'm on the freeway in a blackout, and I hit a family of four. The family of four wound up in the hospital, and I wound up in prison. In prison, I sodomized, man. I was sodomizing. I don't mean to offend anybody, but I did some drugs, too. I was the only one that thought that was strange that night. So anyway, by the time I'm 14 there in Seattle, I'm a neighborhood drunk, I'm the neighborhood pot dealer. I forgot to mention, but my father was a neighborhood Lutheran minister. He didn't find anything funny about this at all. My parents, really good people. And they saw that something was going on with me, but they didn't understand what it was. It was obvious something was going on. By the time I'm 14, my hair is down onto my shoulders and in front of my bloodshot eyes, my vocabulary is, whoa. Whoa, right? That's my vocabulary. But my parents blame my problems on people, place, and things. They thought if we can get him away from that group of kids he's hanging out with, things would get better. If we get him out of that public school system, things would get better. They tried all of the above. But you see, I'm an alcoholic. My problems are not based upon people, place, and things. My problems are based upon my physical and mental relationship to alcohol. You see, if you change the people, place, and things in somebody's life like mine, all that happens is that I'm loaded with different people. In different places, ruining different things. That's all that happens. So by the time I was 17, almost 18, I barely scraped out of the public school system there in Seattle after getting kicked out of the private school system. And my parents decided that Seattle was a problem. We'd get them out of Seattle, things would get better. So they sent me 300 miles away to Washington State University. And I spent 3 years at that university on my parents' money. And in that 3 years, I got almost 10 credits. At any given time, my grade point average matched my blood alcohol content is what was going on. Did nothing at that school. By the time I was 22, this little story I'm about to tell you will let you know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, my father was Swedish, my mother is Icelandic, therefore I look like a polar bear, and I don't know whether this custom I'm about to tell you about is Scandinavian or whether it's Lutheran, I don't know. But at Christmas time, my parents wouldn't just send out Christmas cards to their friends and relatives, my parents would send out this big, long Christmas letter that said everything the family had been doing that year. And when I was about 22, I got a hold of one of these letters that had been sent out the previous Christmas, and as I read it, it let me know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, the first paragraph talked about what my parents had been doing that year. Another impressive year, I'm sure. The second paragraph talked about what the Morris children had been doing that year, and that paragraph went something like this. Our oldest daughter, Christina, just graduated from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, with a master's degree in human resources. She's now working for a large pharmaceutical company in the Midwest. She traveled to Europe this summer. She saw this, she saw that. Her hobbies are this, this, and this. She's a very happy young woman. We are very proud of her. Our oldest son, Eric, just graduated from Western Washington State University with a degree in marketing. He's now working for a large advertising firm here in downtown Seattle. He loves the golf. He loves to travel. He's engaged to be married to this wonderful woman named Mary Lou, who works for a very small company here in Seattle named Microsoft. It was small at one time. And they love to golf together. They love to travel together. He's a very happy young man. We are very proud of him. Our youngest son, Carl, just turned 22. They were actually being very kind, actually. Long story short, and it really would take way too long to elaborate on what I'm about to say, so I just, really, it would take till breakfast to describe everything that happened over the next number of months, number of years. So I just cut to the chase. A really bad night happened, so I joined the Navy. It was that bad of a night. What I'm about to tell you should concern you if you have any idea that you think that the United States should be secure. This should concern you, what I'm about to tell you. I took a test on my way into the Navy, and this test that I took is called the ASVAB test, and this test qualified me to become a nuclear engineer. That should concern you, that the United States Navy would even possibly, maybe, or even remotely allow somebody like me near anything nuclear. This is right at the peak of the Cold War, too. However, they made me take another test when I showed up at that base for boot camp, and I could not pass that particular test. That test is called a urinalysis test, is what that's called. Never knew how to pass it. God, I still remember I'd been in boot camp about 10 days, and the master at arms came into the barracks, and he had a clipboard, and there was about four or five, maybe six names on that clipboard. I knew my name was going to be on that clipboard. I knew. And they took us out of the barracks and took us from the training side of Great Lakes Naval Base over to the administrative side of the Great Lakes Naval Base, and the other guys were taken into one office, and I was taken into a completely separate office, the office of the commander of the whole Great Lakes Naval Base. Beautiful office, big plush carpetings, pictures of naval vessels on the wall, big oak desk, and the man behind the desk had so much gold on, they would blind you on a bad morning. And I stood there, and he asked me my name. I gave him my name, and this would have been the early 80s, and on this big oak desk, he had his telephone with a speakerphone attachment, and he pushed the button on the speakerphone. And into the speakerphone, he said, "Walt, that's my father's name." At this point in 1984, my father would have been in the Navy, both active and reserve, for over 42 years. He'd been active in two and a half wars, because he only did a little bit in one. But this was an old World War II buddy of my father's. Into this phone, he says, "Out of consideration for our long-term friendship, Walt, I thought I should ask you before I took any action on your son. I'm supposed to kick him out right here and right now." He was warned about this, and he went positive for cocaine on his first year analysis test. "What do you think we should do with your son?" Normally, when you met my father, by his body language and his voice, you could tell that he thought life was a huge privilege. The way he acted and carried himself, and his voice especially, you could tell that he loved life, and he loved what he had been given the opportunity to do in life. You could sense it from him. But there was another voice and another body language that would come out of this man sometimes, and it was like somebody had just kneed him right below the belt. And it was always weak and destroyed and confused, and I'd heard that voice many times. But always, when he was dealing with me, ever since I'd been 14 or 15 years old, that weak and destroyed voice, and that's the same voice that came through that speakerphone that morning. I heard that really, really just, his voice at the end of his rope just say, "It's just none of my concern anymore." And I remember just after that, I heard him, my father, click, and then the dial tone. And that man let that dial tone go for probably felt like an hour, probably 30 seconds. Then he looked up at me, and he decided to keep me in the Navy anyway. He took away that nuclear status thing. Thank God for you guys. And a year and a half later, I'm a lower rank than when I first came in. Navy really puts a real premium on showing up in the same place each day in a uniform. They really are sticklers about that. And in fact, you can get away with a lot if you just do that. If you're low-ranking enlisted, if you can just show up in the same place in a uniform, you can really get away with a lot of stuff. I can't do that. What's happening at this point in my life, I'm 23, I'm 24, I'm 25 years old, and I don't know when I take a drink whether it's going to be 3 hours or 3 days. And when I'm coming out of these three-day drunks, sometimes I might find myself in a foreign country, on a large pier, 6 a.m. in the morning going, there was a destroyer here the other day. Then trying to figure out how I'm going to explain that to my superiors when I can't even explain it to myself. been in the Navy almost 2 years at this point, and I was coming out of another 3-day drunk, and I was doing what I always did, and my car was being held together by rubber bands and barely legal on the base, but I was late getting back to the ship early in the morning, and this is pre-9/11, before they got real security. They had real security, but didn't much more now. But at the front of every naval base, there was a guard shack where a Marine stands guard. Under normal circumstances, you're supposed to slowly and politely pull up at the guard shack, show him your military ID. He'll check the sticker on your car. If everything's in order, he'll allow you to proceed onto the base. This particular morning, I guess there was a depth perception problem going on, because what I always did was I would save a pint, and I'd try to drink half that pint on my way into the ship, put the other half a pint underneath the seat, and noontime I'd run back out to the car and down the other half a pint. And I was just doing what I always did, trying to get that half a pint in me. It's my way of sliding into Tuesday, I guess. And I guess I was paying more attention to getting that half a pint in me than where the car was going. And all of a sudden, my eyes came into focus, and the Marine had his head out of the guard shack, like. And I was wondering what he was so excited about until I looked down and saw I was still going 40 miles an hour. I tried to swerve. I yanked the wheel and hit this median on the right-hand side and flipped over and bang, right through that guard shack. I can still see that Marine doing this big dive out of there. He did a quick somersault. He was back up, weapon drawn. Thank God those guys are in good shape. Right? And he was all right. They were patching me up at the hospital for minor injuries, and they were reading new charges on me. And this is nothing significant in my life. New charges, that's just what happens in a guy's life like mine about every 90 days if you're living the way I'm living. But the most significant thing that happened that morning is the Navy doctors prescribed this stuff called Anabuse for me, and they sent this prescription back to the ship's doctor, and I was now under orders to show up every morning before quarters, and the corpsman would put this little white pill on my tongue and make me sit there for a half an hour to make sure it actually ingested in my system. Over the next 7 to 10 days, I started to experience the most cunning, baffling, and powerful side of this illness we call alcoholism, and that is I had no alcohol or drugs in my system, and I was slowly going insane. What I didn't know how to tell anybody, and when people had been taking alcohol away from me for a number of years under numerous circumstances, and now the military is trying to take alcohol away from me. And what I always wanted to say to them is, yes, I agree the price is getting high. I do. Yeah, I really am not happy that that car's on fire either. I'm with you on this. But if you knew how I felt when I wasn't drinking, you wouldn't be asking me why I drink. And I never knew how to verbalize that. I never knew how to explain that to anybody. But that's what they were pointing at my alcoholism, all the things I was doing and the trouble I was getting into. And then they would take alcohol and I'd agree for the first 3 or 4 days. But something would happen inside where my gut would start turning over. My world would close in on me and I would feel like, the best way I've ever heard it described in a meeting is I feel like a scream looking for a mouth. That's the best way I've ever heard it described. So I'm on this Anabuse. I remember counting the days on the Anabuse, just. It's been 4 days. I'm on Anabuse. Now it's been 6 days and I'm on Anabuse. Now it's been 8 days, 6 hours, and 15 minutes. And I'm on Anabuse. And I started to look around that ship. The other men, they're talking behind my back. All 300 of them. Have you ever felt that way in AA? The only difference is that in AA, we are talking behind your back. It's not an illusion, we're really doing it. Apparently you guys don't do that to each other, huh? On the 10th day, I just snapped and I went AWOL from my ship. I locked myself in a little hotel room in downtown San Diego, the Plaza Hotel. It's on 4th and Broadway. This would have been 1986. It was $13 a night. And they've rehabbed that area of San Diego. It's now $19 a night. Locked myself in a little hotel room and I had a bottle of vodka and a shot glass. And as I stared at the bottle of vodka in the shot glass, I remembered that the Navy doctors had given me a very stern warning about drinking on top of Anabuse when they had prescribed it for me. They had said, son, you need to understand that if you drink on top of this Anabuse, you will get one of two reactions. One reaction is you will get violently ill. The other reaction is you might die. I remember looking at the bottle and I thought, wonder which reaction I'm going to get. And I took one shot and nothing happened. Authority had lied to me again, as far as I was concerned. I waited about 2 minutes just to make sure, and I took another shot. All of a sudden, I felt tingly in the face, so I looked in this cracked little mirror that was in this hotel room, and I was bright red, blotchy and purple in places. Took another shot. All of a sudden, I could feel my heart going boom, boom, boom. Looked at my shirt. I was drenched in sweat, and then all of a sudden, I was like, hyperventilating. We're doing all right so far. You guys are really sick if you think this is funny. So I took another shot, and up it came. My second sponsor, late Eddie Cochran, wonderful, one of the pioneers of Southern California Alcoholics Anonymous, got sober in 1951, passed away in 1999 with 47 years of sobriety. He called the next thing that happened to me projectile regurgitation. This is a new level of puking I'm unfamiliar with. Because we all know normal puking. We're all experienced at it, right? Under normal, you know, normally you're out there in the middle of a good drunk, you get that little warning, right? Sour taste in the back of your throat. Maybe a little bit comes up in your mouth and you go, mm. And we all know based upon experience, we have between 30 and 60 seconds to find a bathroom if there happens to be one. If we're driving, we really have learned to try to get the window down because it's a buzzkill for days if you puke in the car. I mean, nobody wants to get in there. You get lonely if you puke in your car. You know, if it's your friend's shoe tonight, that's just the way it goes. But you get the warning. But here on the Antabuse, there's no warning. Just sort of this Linda Blair spray across the room. Thank God the Plaza Hotel is the type of hotel room where the toilet is in the same room with the bed. It's a design feature, I believe. Maybe to make convicts feel more at home upon release. I'm not really sure. But I found the magic of drinking on top of Antabuse that if you hang in there, and it's important, you cannot half measure drinking on top of Antabuse. You really need to make a decision and carry through. And with me, if I would drink and I'd puke and I'd drink and I'd puke for about an hour to an hour and a half, enough of the Antabuse would kick out of my system and I would quit throwing up and I would just be left with red face, hyperventilating and sweating, and I'm pretty much all right with that. So I drank on top of Antabuse for the last 7 months of my drinking. The only words to describe this are desperation drinking. There's no other way to describe this. My second to my last drunk, I was left for dead in a motel parking lot in National City, California. Three guys opened up my face and left me there in a pool of blood. I came to on an operating table. They were resetting my jaw and doing surgery on my face. And they did not use anesthesia because they did not know what level of alcohol or drugs were already in my system, and it's illegal to use anesthesia. So that was a fun morning. My last night of drinking, I'm being let out of San Diego jail, being transferred from civilian authorities back to military authorities. I'm in handcuffs, there's angry people around. And that morning, the officer deck, when the shore patrol was trying to bring me back to my ship, put their arm up and said, wrong answer. Orders have already been processed on this loser. The orders are 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, or treatment. Now, apparently some sort of option was thrown out of the table as I stood there in handcuffs. And I don't remember thinking or feeling, oh God, you're so good to a bum like me. I just can't go on like this. I'm just at my wit's end. Thank God you're offering this treatment. I don't remember that. Nor do I remember, and it would have been more likely that I would have thought, hey, if I just act like I want to do this treatment thing, maybe I can get out of this one too. That would have been more likely, but I don't remember that either. I now know that it wouldn't have mattered what I was thinking or feeling that morning because I was in handcuffs. And I don't know about your experience in handcuffs, but my experience throughout my life was always the same. Whoever had me in handcuffs, never once did they ever turn to me and say, so what's your opinion on this matter, right? It never goes that way in handcuffs. When you're in handcuffs, you go where they say. And I was taken up to the military treatment center up at the north end of San Diego at the Miramar Naval Air Station where the top gun school, pilot school is. Our little section was called Top Drunk. When the doors were locked behind me, that is when they took the handcuffs off me, and that is what society that I live in feels about how Carl Morris acts out in the world without Alcoholics Anonymous, and rightfully so. So I'm going to do this 45-day treatment thing, and various other men and women showed up from other bases and commands, and over the first few days they're doing medical checkups on us. They're trying to contact our ship base or command in order to get our files sent over, and they have us in these group therapy sessions. And in the group therapy session over the first few days, this assistant facilitator was giving us all he had. He had whiteboards, and he's writing, and he's describing the progression of alcoholism and throwing out all sorts of stuff, and he's trying to get us to talk. Nobody's talking. We're just arms folded, looking down the ground, maybe name and, you know, what ship we're from. That's about all we're giving out. We're just looking at the ground. Nobody's happy to be sharing. And he's getting more frustrated, and somewhere around the third day, I think, this one guy raised his hand. His name was Paco. And the facilitator says, yes, Paco, what would you like to say? And Paco says, I hear that I'm supposed to be rigorously honest with you guys if I'm going to do this staying sober thing. And I want you guys to know that Paco's not my real name. Paco's just a name I've always used since I've been a teenager whenever things look like trouble. And the other day when I got here, this looked like trouble. And you're going to find out anyway when my file gets here. But my real name is Randy. Will you guys call me Randy? And we all kind of go, okay, nice to meet you, Randy. But this assistant facilitator got really excited. Said, oh my God, this is the first breakthrough of any honesty of any of you SOBs. Later that afternoon, they gathered us all up again. And they called Randy up to the front. And he walked to the front. And they had a gold name tag with the name Randy on it. They slapped it on his chest. And then they told the rest of us that whenever staffer's not around, Randy's in charge. And Randy loved his new job. And we all hated Randy. On the seventh day in this place, they took us all to our first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. At least it was my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't aware of ever being at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had heard of it, I suppose. You can't be out there drinking too long and not hear of it. You can be out there not drinking and hear of Alcoholics Anonymous, but the perception of Alcoholics Anonymous is always wrong until you get here. So I don't even remember what my perception was. And all I know is that we'd been in this place 7 days, and over the 1MC, it's an intercom system through the barracks, we heard civilian clothes, parking lot, 6 p.m. And we're out there, and five white vans pulled up, and six or seven of us were put into each van, and boom, out in town, each van went, and each one went to a different meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Sure enough, the van I was in pulled up in a meeting, and we sat in the back, and you guys started your meeting. And it was a podium participation meeting. It was much like this room, and probably about the same number of people in Southern California. A lot of the meetings have at least this many people. And a long string of people came up to the front of the room, and the first few read, and the remaining people just sort of talked off the cuff for a few minutes. And I got to tell you, I'm not one of those ones that rejected and rebelled. I don't know if maybe drinking on top of van abuse for 7 months sort of surrendered me a little bit and gave me some open ears. I don't know. But I was 25 years old and sitting in the back of this meeting. You guys didn't even know I was there because Southern California meetings can be big, and it kind of takes the people that are focused in on finding the new people. And I'm sitting there with the military guys, and I'm listening to the things that were read, and the more importantly, the things that were said by those people. And I had this overwhelming feeling of, oh my God, they know. Jesus, they know. Now, if you would have seen me sitting back there and you said, so what is it that they know that you think you know? I would have gone, I don't know, but they know. And what it was is there were two things happening. I believe those people were taking the responsibility of being up at the podium seriously, because they were talking in a way that a new person could identify with. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous wants to happen to the new person, is to identify. And those people, each one of them had their own way of talking about two things that I identified with. I identified with their little story, their stories about their drinking. And it was also strange the way they told their stories, because I'd heard drinking stories. I'd lived drinking stories. I had interacted in drinking stories and told a million drinking stories before I ever got here. But you guys were telling your story in a way that let me know it wasn't happening again tonight. It was weird. You didn't even say it, but I knew that. I believed that you were sober. Then the other thing that was even more important is I identified with the way you described the way you felt when you weren't drinking. That thing that I never had any words to describe or method to come back at anybody with. You guys had a whole vocabulary about it. You acted like it was yesterday's news, that you've known this for a long time. And I just sit and go, whoa. So I identified at my very first meeting. The second meeting they took us to, as much as I identified at the first one, I got equally as confused at the second meeting. I don't know what kind of meeting it was, but everybody at that meeting was talking about something. I don't hear it very often anymore, but back in the 80s, it was common lingo. Everybody at this meeting was talking about something called a drug of choice. People out there saying, well, my drug of choice is. And someone, well, my drug of choice is. And I'm sitting in the back going, oh, for God's sake, was I supposed to be choosing out there? Do they want me to choose now? What are they talking about? So the next morning, back at the treatment center, I asked the counselor who'd been assigned to us. Her name was Mary. I go, Mary, last night in the meeting, they were talking about something called a drug of choice. What do they mean by that? And she said, Carl, let's play a game. Now that worried me because I knew what she was saying. She was saying, pay attention. And that was difficult to pay attention. I hadn't said this to anybody, and I didn't know what was going on at that time. I now know what was going on. When I first got there, they had done medical checkups on me. They found my liver was extended, my pancreas was shutting down. I had extreme alcoholic edema where your skin is, you can push and you can still see the fingerprints. Apparently, drinking on top of Anabuse for 7 months does a little number on your internal organs. So they had given me this cup of pills. They'd salted my tail with this cup of pills to stop me from, you know, they give that to you so because it destroys and scares all the other patients if you start doing the floppy fish and rolling across the floor, and it kind of interrupts the therapy, right? So they give you this cup of pills. But if you've ever been on that cup of pills, you know what I'm talking about. Your field of vision is just fine about here, but there's dancing squiggly things over here. And when you turn to see what it is now, it's over here. And so you're doing this a lot. Right? And so when she said, Carl, we'll figure out what your drug of choice is, let's play a game. I went, okay. And she said, Carl, imagine this. Imagine I came into this room and I had a tray. And on that tray, I had a bottle of Jack Daniels, an ounce of cocaine, and an ounce of Thai sticks. If you're like 25 years old or younger, Thai sticks were the chronic of our day, right? The really good pot. And she said, okay, on that tray, I have a bottle of Jack Daniels, an ounce of cocaine, an ounce of Thai sticks. Which one would you take? I started to drool immediately. Oh, I take them all. And she started to snap her fingers. Settle down. Settle down, Carl. You can't have them all. Play the game. Which one would you take? And I thought for a second. I said, well, if I can only have one, Mary, I guess I'd take the ounce of cocaine. She said, maybe cocaine is your drug of choice. You understand now? And I go, no, no. She goes, what's the problem? I said, well, Mary, the only reason I'd take the ounce of cocaine over the other two is, well, I'd take that ounce of cocaine, I'd get the hell out of here, and I'd sell 2 8-balls. I would now have plenty of money for a quarter pound of Thai sticks and a case of Jack Daniels. That's what I would do. Now, the only reason I bring that up is two reasons. First reason, I'm 25 years old, I'm dying of an illness I know nothing about, but I'm still a smart aleck. That's number one. Number two, if you've been around for a while, I know this has happened to you too, where you learned something and you don't know you learned it until much later when you look back. And on that day, I learned something really valuable about Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's sobriety dates. First of all, we need to get a sobriety date. Alcoholics Anonymous makes much more sense when you have a sobriety date. And it needs to be written in stone. It's the one thing nobody can question about us. Especially ourselves in the middle of the night. And there's only one sobriety date. No, if you're new or fairly new, no matter what you may think your drug of choice is, if you work with a lot of people, maybe you run across this scenario every once in a while like I do in Southern California. Not very often, but every once in a while. Quite often I go, hey, good to see you, how long do you got? And every once in a while, not often, but every once in a while, I get this. Well, my drinking sobriety date is January 4th. My pot clean date is May 3rd. Oh, I blew my methamphetamine date last night. I was in Walmart all night long. No. Funniest thing I ever heard about sobriety date. Same scenario. I saw this guy around my home group for a while. Hey, good to see you. How long do you got? And he said, well, I had 90 days, but I drank last night. So now I have 89 days. I was like, I almost had to call my sponsor and say, I think that kind of falls into the same category as being down in Mexico, looking at the tequila going, would that affect my U.S. sobriety date? Yes, sobriety dates are international. Just a little information for the new guy. So anyway, after 45 days, they're going to let us all out of this treatment center, just what the orders were. And they're going to let us out on a Friday. And on the Wednesday before that Friday, they gathered all 35 of us that were going to get out that Friday into this room. And then the side door opened up and the biggest, meanest counselor in the place came through there. And he's a Marine. That day, he's in his full dress uniform. I got to tell you, a Marine in his full dress uniform is a very impressive, very intimidating sight. And when he walked in his full dress uniform, we were all cha-cha-cha-cha. And he walked in and went, just went quiet in the room. And he walked across, came up to a podium like this, leaned across it and stared at us. Just panned the room. Seemed like forever. It's probably 10 seconds. Then he spoke. He said, you 35 have been through one of the finest treatment centers in the world for alcoholism and drug addiction. This treatment center has been here for many, many years. And over the years, our statistics of this treatment center have shown us that out of you 35, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. Many of you will die, go insane, wind up in prison. Nice little exit pep talk, don't you think? Goodness. Then he said, many will relapse once, twice, maybe 20 times. They make it back into long-term sobriety. But according to this treatment center's statistics, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. Man, if you thought it was quiet before he said that, you could have heard a pin drop in the room now. The only thing you could hear was me going, shit. Because I knew if only one of us was going to make it, it was not going to be me. We all knew who it was going to be. It's going to be Randy over here. By now, he's the poster boy of the treatment center, for God's sake. He's turned in term papers on acceptance and, you know, had four sponsors out there whose names he had. So on this Friday afternoon, they let us all out to go back to our ship's base and commands. But there was about four or five of us that had been arrested in vehicles the night before we were thrown into this place, and we were told that our vehicles had been in an impound lot for the last 45 days. We were to wait on the front door steps of the treatment center for the vehicles to be brought out of the impound lot. So we're standing, I'm looking at the couple other guys, we're looking at each other and kind of fidgety, and all of a sudden one of the guys I'm standing with points at this car coming across the parking lot. And he says, is that Randy in that car? We look a little closer. Yep, sure enough. One of the other guys says, he's drinking already. Sure enough, he's got himself a bottle. He's polishing it off. He rolls right in front of us, rolls down the window, goes, ha ha, throws the bottle right at our feet, crash. We look up, he gives us all the finger, and he drives right off. I guess his name was Paco again. I don't know. The next thing that I remember of that day is I showed up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 6 o'clock gong show meeting in Pacific Beach. And I'm sitting in the back of this meeting, and the truth about my life is I was 45 days without a drink or a drug. I had a lot of information. I was physically feeling better than I have felt since I've been a young teenager. But there had been no spiritual awakening, spiritual experience, or even a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. And what was even more dangerous than that is I did not know I needed one. The one thing I knew is that when I sat in those rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt safe. It's the only time I did feel safe. Didn't matter what was going on in that meeting. I just felt safe sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sitting in the back. One guy that night operating on his primary purpose. I'm sure there were many other men that were operating on their primary purpose that night. This guy was scouring the back rows. One guy operating his primary purpose came up to me and said, hey, never seen you before. What are you doing? I didn't think quick enough to lie to him because I promise you if I would have thought for one more second, I would have lied to him. But I accidentally told him the truth. I said, you know, I just got out of a Navy treatment center earlier today and I don't know what I'm doing. This guy's eyes went bing, big smile went across his face. At the break of the meeting, he's fighting his friends off. Mine, stay limo, I got this guy, right? I didn't know you marked your newcomers around here, for God's sake. But there was something else going on in this guy's life that particular Friday night that made him especially glad to meet me. This guy's girlfriend had left him the night before for one of his friends in his home group. So he was wondering what he was going to do with his weekend, homicide, suicide, get loaded, or grab this newcomer. He's like all over me all weekend. We went to like 18 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. This guy was insane over this woman, flat out insane. In between this barrage of meetings he took me to, he'd throw me in the passenger side of his car, he'd start driving, and he'd start yelling. He didn't even have like a, he didn't even look at the road. He had like one of those AA radar cars that just made it to the next meeting. And he'd be yelling at me, gotta go to meetings, gotta read the book, you gotta get a sponsor. Damn her! Gotta go to meetings, gotta read the book, damn her! And I'm like I was getting spit on the side of my face. Now, I didn't know it, but I was getting a very, very early introduction to your typical AA relationship breakup is what I was getting. But I'm so very glad that that guy, that night, in his pain, was a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous who had done the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, had taken the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and therefore he understood that the solution to his pain was out of self, out of self, out of self. I'm so glad that that guy, that night, in his pain, was not at home underneath his covers, you know, talking on the phone to his sponsor's answer machine. Again, if you're 25 years old or younger, an answer machine was this black box that used to sit on a table. So glad he was not at home underneath his covers whining into his sponsor's answer machine, where are you? Fix me. Give me a magical answer. I'm so glad he was out dragging my sorry butt around. Because he understood that the temporary solution is being sponsored, the lifelong solution is learning to sponsor. And he understood that. He didn't know whether he was going to be my sponsor, but, and he never became my sponsor, but he understood this. He was just using me as a prop in his weekend, so he was so busy he didn't do something really stupid. Right? By going to so many meetings in the same area of town with this guy, I learned something really valuable about how we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially when we're new. I didn't know this when I got out of this treatment center. It kind of explains why you guys all know each other's names. Now, I didn't see anybody else going to 18 meetings, but by going to so many meetings in the same area of town, I saw all sorts of people that were at two or three meetings over that weekend, right? Oh. And so what I learned about how we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially when we're new, I'm going to correlate it to a football game. Now, a football team is out there on the field for one reason and one reason only, to win the game. And how do they win that game? They huddle up, they make a plan, and they do one play. Then they huddle up again, they make another plan, and they do one play. That's exactly what we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the game around here is one day without a drink, you're a big winner. And how do we do that one day? We run in here and we huddle up. We go, remember, we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows. Break! And we go out there and we try a little of this and we try a little of that. And we run right back in here and we huddle up. We go, remember, we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows. And just before we break, some guy in the corner goes, wait, before we break, I've been here for 6 months, I'm sober, but I'm broken, I'm bored, what should I do? An old timer gets up and goes, get a job, son, break! And we go out there and we try a little of this and we try a little of that. And we succeed and we fail, but we run back in here. After that weekend, I got back to my ship, and the one other sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous on my ship out of the all 300 men. There was lots of alcoholics, but there was one sober one. His name was Bob W. He became my first sponsor, and I'm so grateful that the one other sober guy on my ship was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was living a very valuable way of life. He had a sponsor. He had commitments. He knew where all the good meetings were. He had a fellowship going on. He had a sponsor. He was working steps, and now he was going to work with somebody. He only had 14 months. I was going to be the first one he worked with. He was living a very valuable way of life because all he had to do to effectively help save my life was stick his hand out and say, come do what I'm doing. You tell me what level of education in this world we live in, or what position, political based upon wealth or based upon knowledge, what position in our society can anybody else do that? Reach out to the dying and say, come do what I'm doing, and effectively help save their life. I challenge you, who? No doctor can say, come be a doctor and you'll get well. No, right? It's an amazing gift we've been given. And it's easy to forget, whether it be 3 weeks, 3 years, or 30 years into this, it's often very easy to forget this magical gift we've been given. My first 6 months of sobriety were meeting, coffee, 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 meeting, coffee, 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 meet a girl, meeting, coffee, 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 meeting. And I was running from meeting to meeting to meeting, basically all the way from South America up to Alaska and out to Hawaii. And our ship, we'd pull into port, my first sponsor and I, we'd find meetings. And, I was in San Diego a lot, but all over the place. So we were nomads and Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'd go to as many meetings as I could. And I would be running to meetings hoping you would say something funny, clever, or insightful to quiet this. Although I was in meetings and I was like not drinking, how are you, Carl? I'm not drinking! Really, what else are you doing? Well, I'm not drinking. Like it was an event that I'm not drinking. But there was also this thing in me that was still there. And you might find me in the middle of the night, whether it be in my rack on the ship or maybe in a motel room that my first sponsor and I would often split, holding my gut going, what's wrong with me? And I'd say it real soft. What's wrong with me? If this is sobriety, I don't know if I can stay much longer. And I'd run from meeting to meeting because if you said something funny, clever, insightful, it would like release. Maybe I'm all right. No, I'm not. Meeting, 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 coffee, coffee, coffee. And I didn't understand I was dying of untreated alcoholism with no alcohol or drugs in my system sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous. After about 6 months of this, our ship had to go out for sea for an extended period of time, and my first sponsor, Bob, said, when we're out at sea, you're going to meet me in the aft end of the ship, down in the battery shop, in the engine room, every night at 6:30. And I met him there, and he showed up with that blue book, and he tossed it down, and he said, I've been hounding about it for months now. Have you read it? And I said something like, well, yeah, there's how it works. We antagonists, some doctor with some opinion about something. Really, at that point, I wouldn't have known the difference between Dr. Bob, Dr. Paul, and Dr. Silkworth. I wouldn't have known the difference. Maybe there's some people in this room that don't know that difference either. I encourage you to find out who the characters are in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's sort of silly to be here more than 90 days or 6 months and not understand at least Bill and Bob, Roland Hazard, Ebby Thatcher, and Carl Jung. At least that. That'll let you know exactly why we have the privilege of sitting in this room. To not know that and stay here too long would be sort of like claiming to be a devout Christian. And then after a couple of years go, Mary? Was there really somebody named Mary involved in this? That'd be just sort of silly, wouldn't it? Down in that little engine room on the USS Cushing, DD-985, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happened for me. Because he would read and I would read, he would read and I would read, and he shared what little he knew. Remember, he's only 14 months ahead of me. And he was just sharing what his sponsor had just shared with him. And I bet you he forgot and made mistakes. I bet you he confused Roland Hazard and Ebby Thatcher. You know, when you're trying to impress a new good person and tell them a little bit about who the certain American businessman was and who the school friend was and trying to impress the newcomer, I bet you he blew it. Who cares? Who cares? Step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried. It does not say we expertly or properly or without mistake. It says we tried to carry this message. And what happened during that time is I look back at it as Alcoholics Anonymous in its purest form. Us sitting in that little battery shop in the engine room in the middle of the Pacific Ocean with a big book. It was the blind leading the blind, trying to have an experience with a book, and we didn't know what that experience would be. And the experience that we're supposed to have happened for both of us. He got the value of working with somebody else, and I got the first gift I got from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous by going through it was this. Although I might be holding my gut late at night still, I was no longer saying, what's wrong with me? I now had the amazing gift of being able to say, alcoholism. If I don't put a label on that thing that eats me from the inside out, I will be wandering around this planet being misdiagnosed for the rest of my life. And what I have is alcoholism. After 2 years sober, I got an honorable discharge out of the Navy. That was a result of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, an apparently merciful God, and a personnelman that lost half my file. That's how that happened. My first sponsor and his sponsor, real sticklers about that ninth step. I was still push starting the same car I got sober in after 2 years in the Navy. They made me make so many amends. The theory was, until you get even with the world, you don't get to spend a dime out there on yourself. And it was such valuable information that I got to get even with the world before I start spending more money. And I had a long road to get even with the world. I got out, and one of the other amends that I had to make that I was unable to make while I was still in the Navy was my parents had paid for a bachelor's degree. I didn't have one. I had two choices. I know this is bad news for some of you young people. My two choices were either pay them back every single nickel they had wasted on that, or I had to go get what they had paid for in the first place. And so I used some VA benefits and I moved up to Covina, California, which is part of Los Angeles, where I still live. I only meant to go to school there and get the hell out of there, but I have found a life there that was amazing. But I remember 2 years sober, push starting my car and puttering on up the Los Angeles freeways, and I'm thinking, you know what, I need a life. I've heard people talk about having lives in AA. I need one. I can't be an electrician because I'm scared of electricity. That's what they called me in the Navy, that I was an electrician, supposedly. And supposedly. I got to get this degree, and I got to work while I'm getting that degree, and I'm not going to have much chance to go to meetings. But I'll get a life, then I'll get more active in AA. And I'm puttering on up. And I decided to pull into the meeting hall there in Covina to find out where the meetings were. So if I needed a meeting, I could find one. And I remember being very discouraged because the parking lot's flat. When you are push starting your car, one of the tools for living you need is a slight incline. You're always looking for that slight incline. Makes it a little easier. I went into this new meeting, and the man making coffee that day, his name was Eddie Cochran. I told you about him before. Got sober in 1951, which meant he was 10 years sober when I was born. He saw me sitting at this meeting, again, another big meeting, said, hey, never seen you here before. What are you doing? This time I had a much better answer. I said, I am 2 years sober, sir. I'm fresh out of the United States Navy, and I'm here to go to school and work. You won't see me very often because I need to get a life. I'm going to be working hard at getting a life. You'll see me later once I get a life. But I'm going to be real busy going to school and working, and you know I'm taking 21 units at a time, and I got to be self-supporting. And he just chuckled the way he would. Oh, son, school and work, that's wonderful. Got to do it. But that's what we do in between meetings. And what he was really giving me is one of the secrets to long-term AA comfortably, and that is what he was really saying is, son, you need to live in Alcoholics Anonymous and visit the world. Instead of trying to hash it out there in the world and visiting Alcoholics Anonymous when convenient, because that does not work. And I got to tell you, of my friends that I've had over the last 28 years, the ones that put Alcoholics Anonymous first are still here. The ones that don't, they're not here. Or they are constantly coming back, constantly coming back. First thing he told me what I needed to do was put new guys in that car. It's like, why? He goes, your life will get better if you put new guys in your car. I didn't see how that would happen, but I decided to give it a try anyway. And the very first night I did that, I realized he had not lied to me. The very first night I looked over my shoulder, my God, my life got better. The new guys could push start my car. He didn't say how much better, he just said better. I'm going to end in about 3 minutes here. In the last 28 years, I have found a life that I did not even know was available for a guy like me. A life with meaning and purpose, and that really I feel like I'm going somewhere. 17 years sober, I got married. We have two beautiful kids, but the marriage did not work out. I know you've never heard of that in Alcoholics Anonymous, but you know what? What is the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous? Is even under those circumstances, we can figure out a way because we both love those kids from the bottom of our heart. And she's a good mother and she's a good woman. We could figure out how we could be partners in this and quit fighting. And now we are actually pretty good friends and we live very close and the kids coming back and forth at will. Their names are Madison and Ryan. They're 8 and 10. If you're my Facebook friend, you see them all the time. I'm just bang, bang, bang all the time because I'm just so damn proud of them. Right? If you're young and you don't have kids yet, maybe you'll find this out. But if you don't, you will find this level of love another way, I'm sure. And you probably already have. But I didn't know this level of love that I could have until I had kids. Man, it's like I met who I would die for. I know when I joined the military, they made me raise my hand and say I would die for you. I was hoping it was not going to come to that. Really, I was. But with my kids, it's like, let's put it this way. I love a lot of people. You know, if I'm in Starbucks later with Larry or with Jerry, and somebody comes in wielding a gun and says, it's either the two bald guys or you. I would go, have you met Jerry or Larry? They're my, right? But if it's my kids, I would dive right in front of that bullet without even thinking. I would never trade my kids for the first drink. Never in a million years would I trade my kids for the first drink. But I'm alcoholic. I know what it means to be alcoholic. Although I would never trade them for the first drink, I would trade them for the second drink. Like that. So there is nothing that is more important than me staying in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because what's forefront in my mind is to be a really good dad. That's what I want to be. I want to be a really good dad. But if without you guys, I don't even get a chance to do that. So again, I'd like to thank you guys for allowing me to come here and take an action that once again to remind me I stay in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're here in Atlanta. The biggest deal in the whole world is happening down the street. If you can get there one way or another, beg, borrow, or steal, or sneak in, I don't know. Figure it out. Get down there and join us. It's going to be a huge celebration. It's going to be the center of the recovery world, and it's happening in your backyard. If you don't go, I promise you, a year from now, you're going to regret it. If you see me down there, please stop me and say hi, and that's it. Have a good night.